are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. You're very welcome to join us in Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we are going to be talking to Katrina Carrasco. She has written a really exciting novel. It's her first. It's called The Best Bad Things. And guess what? It's set in Port Townsend in 1887, the height of the Victorian era. But this is not about the ladies mincing up the steps to Uptown. This is much more about what's happening down on the wharf. And let me tell you what Publishers Weekly had to say about it. Carrasco succeeds in coupling a feminist historical that maintains period plausibility with an exploratory queer narrative rarely seen in the crime genre. Breathtaking, pacing, tantalizing rough-and-tumble characters who are somehow both distasteful and deeply relatable. Palpable erotic energy and powerful storytelling make this book a standout. Well, welcome, Katrina. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thanks for having me here.
Well, we want to hear your words, so why don't we start just by beginning with a reading that can get us into the feel of this book.
Sure. I was going to start out with just reading from chapter one. So this is it, chapter one of The Best Bad Things.
Okay.
January 12th, 1887. Last time Alma wore this shirt, she ended up in jail. The cotton still carries a cell block tang of piss and mildew. Straw crackles on the sleeves. Ruddy blotches dot the shirt's collar. Tobacco juice? No. The fight that landed her in lockup comes back clear. Bone crush, jaw clench, freight train heart. The marks are blood. That was a damn good night. Next to the shirt is a pair of socks, wadded into a bristling lump. Alma unknots the wool, angles out a snub-nosed knife. When she tests it on her forearm, dark hairs gather on the blade like iron filings on a magnet. Pins nip her scalp as she pulls them free. An auburn wig comes loose. She drops it onto the cot where it curls among other castaway layers. Oilcloth capes, green silk bodice, green silk skirt, lacy petticoat. A corset slumps gutted beside a sweat ring shift and cotton stockings. She chafes a damp rag across her cheeks, across her wrists and knuckles, stripping off a thick coat of cosmetic powder. Wearing only her own skin and hair, she is unbound, powerful. She can mold her form into any shape. But the nakedness also knocks her askew, kicks open an unlit pit. Who would stare back at her in a mirror when she has not arranged herself? Who is Alma when she stands naked and silent in a threadbare rented room? Leave that thought. Be glad there is no looking glass here. Be glad for the smash and racket of the couple next door, the distraction of their fighting or fucking. The noise is an impetus. Put on a new costume. A new performance has begun. To lacquer on manhood, Alma starts with the hands. Gentlemen wear rings. A working man wears calluses. He leaves dirty fingerprints on newspapers, drops peanut shells in his path. His nails may or may not be bitten. In winter, his knuckles crack with cold. She shakes open a sackcloth bundle. Inside is a warped metal pipe, slick with grease, caked with ash. A sailor sold it to her from a dockside box of scraps. He said its explosion unmade a boiler room and nearly sent its ship to the bad place. Only faint sneers of French toss remain between her fingers. Gripping the pipe, she twists her hands in opposite directions. Twists so the pipe's grease grits into her skin and its metal ridges rouse the nerves of her palms. Remember how to talk like Jack Camp. Rough voice, tobacco-muddied tongue. Grip, twist. Remember how to move like Jack Camp. Hips first, cocksure. Twist. Remember how to fight like Jack Camp. And at this, Alma smiles. This is her favorite thing. The red and sweat and swearing. The fire in her ribcage. The bend and crush of bodies. Muscles contracting. Sunbursts of pain, nothing but the pummeling, the wild onrushing of life. As camp, she could be a thief, thing. I was on a crew in the city. We ran small-time jobs, liquor, queered cash. Your place looked like easy pickings, and your boy sure as shit didn't put up much of a fight. She tosses the pipe aside, curls her palms around the desk lamp. Its chimney funnels warm air onto her face as she inspects her fingers. They feel stronger. They feel sturdier. Soot and hairline scrapes form a blackened patchwork on her skin. Alma pulls on the long woolen socks, narrows her mouth, her eyes. No lace trimming softens men's small clothes. The mold-soured shirt is rough against her armpits, rough against the bruised flesh of her throat. With each layer, her breath comes faster. She hungers for heat, for movement, and salt. As camp, she could be a gambler, saying, "He owes me $50. Gets right out of a card game, the son of a bitch. I don't know who you are, mister, but if you're not prepared to front for him, I'll beat him again until he pays up." Knife into belt. Put out the lamp. Throw two jabs and a cross in the darkness just to feel the swing snap of muscles under stiff oilcloth. Dressed, armed, kindled to sweat, she slips out of her room. And that's Alma.
That is Alma.
Pretty good intro to her.
it is a good introduction to a very complex dual nature character of Alma Rosales and Jack Kemp. But we need to read a lot more to really understand her and to understand the book. Can you describe the book for the uninitiated?
Yeah, so it kind of fits at a nexus of genres, which makes the summary a little tricky depending on who you're trying to get interested in. But it's kind of a mystery crime story that's set in the Victorian era in Port Townsend. And it follows a main character who's a Pinkerton's detective who's trying to infiltrate an opium smuggling ring. And the main character is also a queer person who's navigating queerness in a time when it was read and performed and lived very differently than today. So there's lots of kind of moving parts in there, but they're all really important to the narrative.
Well, it really is a mix of genres. How did you decide to incorporate both historical fiction, mystery, and even like a literary novel? How did you decide to do that?
So for me, the book is really a character study. I feel like it asks its thesis question on the first page is who is Alma? Mm-hmm. Who is Alma Rosales? And I think the book is a character study of her and just the different ways that she lives and performs aspects of her identity. And I felt like a mystery was kind of a good container for that to kind of get her going. And the historical aspect side was also interesting and important because I really love the setting and the history behind the novel. A lot of research went into it. So the setting kind of came to me sort of preformed in some ways. But I think it adds a lot to navigating and exploring queerness when you had these really intense social pressures of how the male and female spheres were very divided. So it just gives a different flavor to the exploration than if it had been set in the same place in modern times.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are the two things that I really want to talk about. I want to talk about all of the characters in this book because I really felt that it was character driven, but it's also really place driven. So how did you decide to land in Port Townsend for this book? You were in Portland. That's a gritty place.
Yeah, I lived in Portland for a while and now I live in Seattle. And I've been sort of moving around Puget Sound. About around the time I moved to Portland, actually, I was given a book that I really adored. It's by Richard Dillon, and it's called Shanghaiing Days. And it's a compendium of kind of maritime crimes on the Pacific seaboard, also a little bit on the East Coast, but really focusing here. And starting with the age of Shanghaiing, and it's the birth of that practice in San Francisco during the gold rush, where all these ships came in, everybody ran to get gold. There was no one to crew them out, so they were just rotting in the harbor, and desperate captains started kidnapping men, sometimes not even sailors, just working men to crew their boats. And about the farthest place you could sail was Shanghai. So that was kind of the least desirable voyage because you might never come home. So that was where the practice of Shanghaiing was kind of born. And that continued along the Pacific coast up until the early 1900s. But there was a lot more than that going on. There was also a lot of smuggling. There was other maritime crime. The port cities were really bustling, so they were just kind of new kind of cultural hotspots in certain ways where people from all over the world were mingling and mixing, and just really vibrant setting for exploration in novels. And Port Townsend, as it turns out, has a chapter in that book because it was an extremely active site of the smuggling trade, specifically opium. At the time of the book in the 1880s, opium was not illegal in the United States, but it was really heavily taxed, smokable opium. So the smugglers were tax evaders, and they made small fortunes. So Port Townsend was known for having an extremely corrupt customs house. It was the main customs house for Puget Sound. So everyone
let's talk about where that customs house was, because everybody's thinking, yeah, oh, it's the customs house that's a post office. But no, it wasn't.
No. It's a little building that's, I think there was a cafe there for a while.
Yeah, and it's the empty lighthouse cafe with Better Living Through Coffee hanging out over the water. That is that's the customs house that was very corrupt. Okay, keep going.
Yeah. Oh, there's a little plaque on that building too, so you can see, like, this was the site of the customs house, which is always, I love visiting Port Townsend. I spent a lot of time there when I was researching, just to be kind of in the town, getting a feel on the ground there. And it's just so rich with all of the different historical buildings that have been preserved and the markers around town that show you which ones those are. I think it's just, it was very wonderful as an author to get to do research in a town that's so proud and respectful of its history.
Right.
So,
well, because the railroad didn't come here is really the reason that these Victorian buildings still are here, because it kind of fell apart. It busted after the boom. But I want you to mention that book, Shanghaiing Days Again. How do you spell Richard Dillon's last name so that our listeners could possibly find it?
Yes, I believe it's D-I-L-L-O-N.
Okay.
And it's probably out of print.
Yeah.
I have a very old copy. It's an old book. I think he might have published it in the 70s or even earlier, which is also kind of amazing because it does contain some of the very last, you could say, like, first-person accounts of men who, as young men, either were Shanghaied or knew someone who'd been Shanghaied or knew about the practice.
Well, dear listeners, it might be in the McCurdy Library down at Point Hudson, but if not, you can always interlibrary loan Richard Dillon's Shanghaiing Days. And we also need to mention Tom Canfield. So you also used his book as research?
Yes, I found that book to be invaluable. I've turned to it for so many things, just about having a local's insight on what the town was like, reading about different anecdotes of the people who lived here. He has a lot of information in there about the custom house, a little bit less about the opium, but definitely it's mentioned. And just, I felt like that was my Bible when I was writing this book. It's heavily underlined. My copy's full of post-it notes and highlights and writing, and it's kind of, you can't recognize it anymore as what it might have been, but it was very, very useful as a resource.
Okay, so that's Thomas Canfield's Port Townsend, An Illustrated History. I think it's volume one and volume two, and it's a book that the library has multiple copies of. A lot of history here in Port Townsend, and let's talk about, before we get into all the characters, also the plot. It's a mystery, and you use also some transcripts of interviews interspersed. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to do that? Did it forward the mystery? Did it give clues?
I don't want to give anything away about toward the end of the book, but the transcript and the book tie together, obviously, or they wouldn't be together. And I liked the narrative questions that it brought up. I liked giving readers a break because sometimes the text is kind of dense. It was a very fun way for me as an author to sort of like flex playwriting muscles. That's kind of what I was going for, where you can't show anybody doing anything. They're just talking. So it was fun as an exercise to speak to playwriting friends that I have, ask them for their advice, try it out, see how much I could convey when I couldn't give any stage directions, which I love writing about atmosphere and bodies. So it was a particular challenge to not have those things in the transcript. But I saw them kind of as an engine, you know, because they do start at a different day. And
they
you wonder.
Well, to me as a reader, they were like sometimes like clues, like mystery readers like to sort of guess what's going to happen or try to figure it out. And that was a time when I was going, okay, now what is this and what's going to happen? It was kind of a little bit of foreshadowing. But let me stop here and reintroduce you. I'm talking to Katrina Carrasco about her book set in Victorian Port Townsend. It's called The Best Bad Things. And it's a lot about Port Townsend in the 1880s. But it's also comes from Katrina's experiences too, and I'll ask her to talk about that as well. And the characters, there are a lot of strong women characters in this book. So we begin with the main character, Alma Rosales, who also most of the book she is Jack Camp. Why did you decide to make her your heroine?
Yeah, I came up with Alma very early on when I was envisioning the book. A lot like the other history, I tried to pull from the Pinkertons agency history to create this character. And something that was an interesting anecdote, little tidbit, was that the agency did have a women's bureau when they were founded. The founder really thought that women could be very effective in undercover detective work. Mm-hmm. And so there was a women's bureau. They had trained agents. There was a female agent who helped protect President Lincoln at one point. They were active in the field. And then his sons took over when he got older and passed away. And they didn't think that women could be doing this work. They thought it was inappropriate. So they disbanded the women's bureau. And I just, in that tiny piece of history, I saw an opportunity. I was like, okay, you have this highly trained force of female detectives who are now kind of mad at authority and don't have jobs. Surely some of them would realize they could put their talents to use, you know, in other perhaps non-legal ways. And that was sort of my starting point for Alma. I really wanted to have a character also, specifically a female character. She is queer. She does use a male identity, but I chose to use she, her pronouns for her just because given the time and the way she kind of experiences her body, I didn't really envision her as trans. Mm-hmm. Perhaps in current days, she might identify as non-binary, but that term wasn't really available. So I kind of let her drive her own experience of gender, but stuck with the she, her pronouns for the purposes of the book. A person who mostly identifies as female, having a very physical experience of their body. I think women in fiction and, you know, even just in our daily life are not really given permission in some ways to be strong or active or to like conflict, to like combat or fighting. When I was doing research for the book, I read a lot about some female boxers. There's a female boxer for the U.S. team who's won a bunch of prizes, and she is finding it hard to get sponsors because it's hard to sell a woman who likes fighting, like a woman who is strong and enjoys that. And so it's not just in fiction that we see this kind of limitation on women's bodies happening. And I wanted a character who just was the total, just delighted and was energized by physical conflict, by the adrenaline rush, and wasn't told that she couldn't be that way necessarily,
right.
or at least made her own way so she could.
Well, that's what made this book kind of fascinating and scary for me to read. It was kind of not only a mystery, but it was exposing the mystery of this kind of queer experience and this excitement about violence that is an arousal around violence. So you did an incredible job of describing this. It was kind of first person. And also the part about, and I don't think I'm giving much plot away here, but, you know, someone is injured. And your description of that, I don't think I've ever read anything like that about the kind of the loss of consciousness, but being conscious and the pain and the not the pain, that the physical description of actually being beaten and shot, how did you come to be able to write that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a bit of imagination there. I have neither been beaten nor shot.
Okay.
I'm glad to say that. But I think, too, I've always been an athlete. I've always been in sports. I've done different kinds of sports. I actually took boxing lessons for a couple years while I was writing this book to sort of get in the world of boxing, which comes up a bit, know the terminology, know that I knew what I was talking about when I named a kind of punch. And I think I kind of situated Alma in a place where this sort of activity would energize her. And I think I saw that a lot at my boxing gym. I didn't experience this. You know, the first time I was sparring, got punched in the face, I was very like taken aback and not happy about it. So I'm not writing, you know, as Alma, but, or I should say Alma and I are not the same person. But I did see a lot of the fighters at my gym describe that when they got punched, it made them kind of like energized to keep fighting.
Oh.
It brought them to a higher level of, you know, physical awareness. It made them faster. It made them a little mad. And that enabled them, because, you know, in a boxing match, you're going to get hit. And it's kind of the mental adjustment of being able to absorb that and sort of use it and channel it back outwards. And I was really fascinated by that kind of fighter's mentality. And I did try to write that in for Alma. There was a book that I think it's called The Fighter's Heart that I read. It's nonfiction. And it's a man who traveled around the world basically training for and participating in various fighting sports. And he wrote a lot about the body. It's the same thing I'm describing where, you know, how to take a fight and be strengthened while you're in it in a way. So his language and experience of different kinds of fighting, because he gets very badly beaten up in the course of his writing and reporting of that book. That was a helpful way to kind of inform the language I was using, as, you know, for some of it, for a lot of it, I couldn't personally relate, but I was able to pick up on some of that lexicon and that idea.
I'd like to read another quote about your book, and this is from Nicola Griffith, who is the author of Hild. She's one of my favorite interviews that I was, you know, able to talk to her, and she visited us here in Port Townsend. She says, "Gritty street fiction set in the lawless past when Port Townsend was the Deadwood of the Pacific Northwest. Katrina Carrasco's The Best Bad Things is a bloody brawl." Can't you just hear her saying that? Of a book. Carrasco uses a whippy structure and flexible prose to play an unsettling shell game as Alma, dressed as Jack, sheds her impulse control along with her corsets, and the plot accelerates into a visceral, unexpected underworld of bare-knuckle fighting, opium smuggling, and genderqueer lust. So there you go. I thought that was
Love that. That
was a great review. So let's go back to Port Townsend and some of the people in your book. There's Delphine, Nell, and these two characters are Nell is a sex worker, but she's portrayed in a very positive light. She's a wonderful, loving person. And Delphine also is kind of a mastermind, and she's come up from San Francisco. So who are the models for these kind of characters?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, just to shout out to Nicola, she's a friend of mine and has been wonderful and just a mentor in this writing process. And I got to know her through, we have the same publisher. So she's just been, speaking of strong women, she's been just an invaluable presence. And I just wanted to say that when her name came up. As far as Delphine and Nell, and also including Alma in this as well, I really wanted to continue to have a book that portrayed women in ways that were typically not allowed to be portrayed. Again, like I feel like this book has a lot to say about how women are allowed to act. And I just want to have characters who we're not constrained by how we expect women typically to be portrayed or acting. Nell, I think, is a wonderful character I really enjoyed spending time with. She is very smart. I mean, all the women in this book are just, in, you know, masterminds in their own way.
Yes, quick on their feet. And,
yeah. Nell kind of is a mastermind in like a person-to-person setting. She knows how to talk to people. She knows how to get them to open up to her. It's like it's a skill that she has. And I thought she was a great foil for Alma, who's very closed up about personal things when she actually pauses long enough to have a conversation with someone. So I loved having the two of them together. It was really important for me to have a positive depiction of sex work in this book. Sex work is work, and I wanted to have a character who wasn't defined by that work, but was, you know, playing her own part in the story where that was kind of just an incidental part of her character. Delphine is an incredibly intelligent person who's kind of, you find out very soon, I guess this isn't really a spoiler, she's toward the top of the opium business.
Right.
And she knows everything that's going on, and she's four steps ahead of everyone. And I thought she was really fun to write as well. Just someone who's so capable and so able to have three plans ready at a moment's notice. With very complicated situations. So I wanted to have a lot of female characters. Given the time period and the setting, it was a little challenging because this is very much like a men's domain. It takes place on the docks. There wouldn't have been as many women there if I, you know, as compared to a different setting. Mm-hmm. So when I did find a place for female characters, I really wanted them to shine and be very multifaceted and complicated and give them the space to be that way and yeah. not be defined by their job or their gender and just let them kind of play right. alongside Alma to see how it went.
Right. These are people that are usually victims that you've said, mm-hmm. you know, they usually end up dead somewhere during, you know, they're just used as bodies. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, they're the people that are the survivors. So back to Port Townsend history. One of the fun things that I had, and I want to mention this to the listeners, is there is an interactive map located from a link in Katrina Carrasco's website. Her publisher, MCD Books, has this interactive map of Port Townsend that shows the places in the story and what they are now. And so you will recognize them, although some of the places are now parking lots, which allows for the fiction to hold place. But, you know, the cannery's in there. What's elevated? I forget. Can you remember what's happening at Elevated Ice Cream? Anyway.
Oh, I think that was maybe...
The boarding house.
Yes.
Sloan's
boarding house.
Yes, yeah, the so. Infamous boarding house. The crimp. Sloan's boarding house is Elevated Ice Cream. I thought that was hysterical. And the whole Chinese section, which we did have in Port Townsend, is the antique mall on Washington Street. So, you know, the opium den, the laundry... The place where you can buy herbal apothecaries and everything else is also there. And you did a great job of having people from all ethnic backgrounds in this story. So that was something else that made it a winner for me. I just really want to thank you for joining us today, Katrina. Katrina Carrasco, her book, The Best Bad Things. And it's bad, but it's really good too. So join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. And you can listen to past shows or this show again if you came in halfway through on the podcast page on the website at kptz.org. You can make a donation to the station there as well. Carl Allen is the editor who smooths out all the rough edges. And thanks to all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible.